Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Hey, and welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nadolski, and we got my co-host, Dr. Carl, super endocrinologist. And with us today, we have Dr. Andrea Love.
Jeez.
I wanted to do that joke so bad. You know, who do you love? Whatever.
Yeah. Okay. Well, hopefully Dad listens to this because he's the only one that's going to like that.
I bet you never heard that one before.
No, Dr. Love. Jokes about my last name ever. Nope.
never heard that one. Okay. Dr. Love. So you have the unbiased, how do you say it?
Yeah, unbiased science podcast. Yep.
Side podcast. And I've been on your podcast. We've made some posts together, made some people mad about the BMI, but like you're actually like an expert in immunology and microbiology. And that's what you got your PhD in. And we wanted you to come on here to talk about like all things microbiome, because inevitably, you know, in our context, we always talk about the diet sodas and everybody's like, well, what about the microbiome? It's like, well, what about it? So anyway, we wanted an expert to come on to talk about all of that. So welcome.
I'm super excited to be here. I have a lot of strong feelings about the misinformation or kind of the overestimation of, you know, microbiome in the context of disease. We see a lot of buzzwords circulating on social media where everybody's like, oh, it's going to change your microbiome. And it's like, yeah. And a lot of folks want to use that as a way to fear monger. And so I think it's really important for people to understand kind of what we know, what we don't know, you know, and what's real.
What the hell is a microbiome?
Or they use it to, they sell stuff. It's always so many quacks. I mean, it's interesting, like, you know, when we're going through medical school and stuff, we start learning more like, oh, there's a lot more to this microbiome than we used to think, right? And we know it's very important and all these things. And then suddenly the quacks took it.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
And they went full quack and now we can't have a nice things.
Yeah. And that's, you know, I mean, that's what a lot of these sort of pseudoscience things, you know, prey on, right? They take a nugget of truth or a nugget of information and they kind of extrapolate it. And so, you know, really broadly speaking, the microbiome are the environment of microorganisms that live in and on our body. And that's when we talk about the human microbiome, but there's microbiome everywhere, right? In ecology, in other animals, in any organism. And this includes the entire collection. So you've got things living in and on your skin, in your mouth, in your mucous membranes, your vaginal microbiome, but a lot of attention is on the gut microbiome. And so in the gut, in the GI tract specifically, there are bacteria, there are fungal organisms, there are viruses, and these are part of that entity. There's estimated to be about 100 trillion different bacteria within the gut microbiome alone. And rough estimates right now, it's about at least 500 different species. So it's really diverse, really complex, and just, you know, tons and tons of different bacteria that are living in our gut. And, you know, this is this microcosm of life that helps us maintain our health, our physiology. We know that certain bacteria are required for synthesis of vitamin K because humans can't do that themselves. And without those bacteria living in our gut, we wouldn't be able to extract that from the foods we eat. But on top of that, you know, the bacteria, they help digest things, they help metabolize nutrients, they also help train our immune system, the bacteria in the gut, because what they do is they prime our immune system to recognize these components of bacteria, certain sugars and proteins, and the immune system is like, oh, hey, that's not human, but that's supposed to live in my gut, so I'm not going to respond to that. But then when they encounter a pathogen, a bacteria, a microorganism that can cause disease, they're like, oh, that's not the same as the one that's living in my gut. I should sound the alarm and I should respond to that. And of course, they also participate in a phenomenon called microbial antagonism, which is the fact that since they live there and they take up the square area of the gut, it prevents other things from colonizing the gut.
That's amazing. You know, it's interesting because Spencer, you know, you have a certain...
This will be good.
Well, Spencer has a certain, you know, specific microbiome, and it's often sounding the alarm through his loud flatulence.
I was going to talk about how many, you have like double the however many trillion, 500 trillion.
Well, that, you know, but that's exactly right, right? So, you know, these bacteria, they're digesting things, right? They're helping us when we eat something, it's going into the stomach. You have enzymes that are starting the digestive processes in your mouth. It's entering the stomach. There's stomach acids. There's other enzymes that are secreted. And eventually it's going to make its way into, you know, the small intestine and ultimately the large intestine and the colon. And throughout this, you have these bacteria that are helping us to digest these substances and not just helping us digest them, but they're actually using it as their food source, right? Because everything needs food. And these bacteria utilize different macromolecules, different components of proteins and fats and carbohydrates in order to survive, reproduce, and also assist us with the bodily functions they assist us with.
Yeah, you're talking about reproduction, secretions, and all sorts of things. So there's some people listening to this that are just like, all right. Hey, let's talk about Clostridium difficile, because that's what we see clinically in the hospital. That's where like we get introduced as physicians into this realm, and it's very clinically relevant.
Yes.
Can you talk about that real quick?
Commonly known as C. diff.
C. diff, yes. Clostridium difficile. It's a bacteria that typically infects or colonizes the large intestine, and it can be very problematic, especially for individuals who are already, you know, they have some sort of medical indication, right? They're typically in the hospital and they're sick or they're being treated for something. And it's considered a nosocomial infection for that reason, where it's, you know, hospital acquired essentially. And C. diff normally is kind of fended off by all of the microbiome that's currently living in your gut. But when people have disturbances in the populations of microorganisms that are there, Clostridium difficile can basically enter and overwhelm what's left in there and colonize and create a lot of medical issues. So it's often, it leads to colitis, which is inflammation of the colon. And that's often due to individuals in the hospital who are being treated long-term with broad spectrum antibiotics. So you're essentially killing off the things that are causing an illness, but it's also killing off those healthy bacteria that you want to be living in your GI tract. And so when you get a C. diff infection, it can cause very severe illness, diarrhea, abdominal pain, fever. And unfortunately, C. diff particular strains can be resistant to many of the commonly used antibiotics, which is why they're able to colonize when you'd be wiping out others. And so it can be very difficult to treat and it can be life-threatening.
I mean, this is like the very clinical, pathological reason we care about the microbiome. As physicians, we all, you know, had to go through the hospital rounds and we saw that often. We're there treating a pneumonia and then all of a sudden they get C. diff and then all sorts of complications.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think it's kind of an interesting, just very clinically relevant change in the microbiome that's like, hey, this is like life threatening. Yeah. Whereas, like,
and it happens acutely, like it's bam.
Yes,
it's right
exactly.
There,
it's... And I think the biggest distinction there is that C. diff is colonizing when you've essentially wiped out the population. So the hundreds of trillions of bacteria that should be in the gut aren't there anymore. They're not adhering to the intestinal walls. They're not preventing other bacteria from coming in and grabbing onto those intestinal walls. And so it leaves the environment in your gut essentially empty or barren so that C. diff bacteria can come in. That's very different from, you know, what we hear often in the buzzword realm of changes within your microbiome.
Yeah. So let's get into these kind of more like physiological changes that I'd love to learn a little bit more. Cause like, let's say for example, the diet soda thing, cause I know there's some issues and you'll probably be able to know this better with how they're even testing this and whether there would have been changes regardless of if they even did any experimental differences in that person. It can vary throughout.
Yeah. I was just going to say, and backing up even before that is where did that notion even come from? You know, we hear about these different good bacteria, bad bacteria that are somehow correlated to potential, like some of us maybe have better microbiomes for maintaining lean body count. I don't know. Like, there's a metabolic aspect to it that gets a little, we say, oh yeah, okay, it plays a role, but like, it gets beyond our nuanced comprehension.
Yeah,
exactly. Like, well, that's exactly right. Right. So we know that there are hundreds of different species, and in every single individual, they are in different proportions, right? Every single person has a different ratio of these different species of bacteria that are living in the gut. So you can't really say like what's a normal microbiome, because it's all relative to what you are. And we know that there are certain microorganisms, certain bacteria that are better able to metabolize and extract energy, which we think of in terms of calories, but in our body, it's ATP. And those bacteria maybe are better able to metabolize and extract energy from fats or from proteins or from carbohydrates. And so individuals who have higher proportions of those bacteria, they may be more sensitive to changes in weight fluctuations, as an example, or a metabolic marker when they eat foods that have certain proportions of those macromolecules. But you can't just say, okay, well, these bacterial species are bad and these are not, because again, it's all relative. And there's so many different species. And so there's so much we don't know about the microbiome. And so there's been a lot of exploratory research, right? What they're doing most often is taking fecal samples. So about 50% of the dry mass of your stool is bacteria. And so what researchers will do is they'll take stool samples and they'll look at kind of the genetic profile of the bacteria that's shed in the stool. And so you can look at some comparative data there, but it doesn't account for bacteria that are maybe further up in the GI tract that aren't shed as easily, or they produce molecules, adhesion molecules that allow them to hang on to the intestine better. So they might not be sheared off by all of that, you know, muscle contraction during kind of bowel movement. And so unless you're, you know, physically taking biopsies or samples of every single region within the GI tract, you can't say for certain that you're sampling everything that's in there. But what they've done,
there's flaws in the measurement.
Yeah, exactly. There's limitations in how you're collecting the information. And on top of that, a lot of these things are kind of exploratory. They're observational, right? So they're looking at changes, but they're not saying, okay, well, that is causing a clinical manifestation. So you can say, okay, well, these people ate sugar sweetened beverages for 6 weeks. These people ate beverages sweetened with aspartame. These people ate beverages sweetened with stevia. These people ate beverages sweetened with sucralose, all, you know, non-nutritive sweeteners of different derivations. And you can say, okay, well, these people had, you know, this proportion of bacteria. These people had this and this and this. And they might be different, but that doesn't mean that one is inherently bad and one is inherently good. It just means that the bacteria that are metabolizing or responding to those sweeteners, those molecules, are different because they're being provided a different carbohydrate source. And, you know, when we talk about artificial sweeteners, we think about them as being like synthetic and zero calories, and, you know, our body isn't able to process them. But in reality, there are all carbohydrates. They're just ones that human cells can't extract energy from. So that's why they're non-nutritive, right? They essentially go undigested by us. But bacteria can still utilize them and harvest substances, molecules within those different chemicals. Because again, everything is chemicals.
So like the Bacteroides and what is it?
Firmicutes, Bacteroides.
Firmicutes, yep. Bacteroides. They have a ratio.
Those are the ones we always hear about. Yeah.
Because so, and those are like two really big phyla of bacteria that live in the gut. But even within those, you have different classes, you have different orders, and then you have hundreds of species. And there's also a lot of redundancy. So if you're like, oh, well, I looked at this and I saw that my Lactobacillus gasseri population decreased, but then the, you know, Bifidobacterium lactis population increased. Those actually can serve redundant functions. It's not like one species alone is doing one thing. There's a lot of overlap. So even if one population declines, there's usually another population that's compensating. So it's reproducing. And you have to think of it as like, you know, a cosm, right? So if one species is better able to digest a certain molecule, they're going to extract that nutrient, they're going to reproduce. And as a consequence, another bacterial species that isn't as good at metabolizing that is probably not going to reproduce as quickly. So you're going to see these natural fluctuations based on anything you eat on a day-to-day basis, because these are living organisms. It's dynamic. It's never going to be the same every single day.
Then this goes to then the, you know, the probiotics and the prebiotics that people are studying and using. And oh boy, that gets complicated too. Like, what is the, what does it all mean, oh. Basil?
Yeah. And so with probiotics, because, you know, when you're looking at the dosage of those, it's really a drop in the bucket. They're looking at maybe a billion bacteria when you're comparing to 100 trillion. And so in reality, there's really not a ton of clinical evidence that they're beneficial for healthy individuals. There are some very specific medical indications. For example, if you had, you know, broad spectrum antibiotics in very young children who didn't really have a developed immune system, that it can help kind of replenish. But a recent study, because these probiotics are typically like between 1 in 10 species, so it's not the diversity that you normally have in your gut. And the reason for that is because those are the species that are easy to grow in a lab in large quantities. So they can grow them up, they can, you know, lyophilize or freeze dry them, and then people can take them. But what they found is that some of these probiotic supplements actually reduce the diversity of the gut, because now you're taking this one species and you're giving a dose of it to your gut. And so now you're kind of pushing out some of the other species that should be there in the first place. So, you know, again, I'm not a proponent of probiotics. I have not seen any convincing data that, you know, people should be taking them or that they can help with kind of, you know, this gut balancing. You know, we hear all sorts of medical claims related to the gut. We know the gut and the microbiome is important. You can't take that information as a diagnostic, even if you do one of those at-home microbiome tests and then say, oh, well, I'm going to eat, you know, foods X, Y, and Z, and that's gonna rebalance my microbiome, because that's not how it works.
Yeah, that's good. That's good.
That is good stuff there. Yeah, that's great.
So what about the prebiotics?
Yeah, then? So I mean, prebiotics is really just a fancy word for fiber, right? So prebiotics are basically the food sources that the bacteria in your gut are going to use as energy. So, you know, we often talk about fiber as, you know, a catch-all for indigestible carbohydrates and lignin, which we need for lots of things, right? We talk about GI function, stool bulk, but it also, again, feeds our microbiome. It also is involved with LDL cholesterol levels and lipidemia and things like that. And I'm sure you too know a lot about that. But the prebiotics are really kind of a separate entity. And, you know, prebiotics you're getting from your food, right? If you eat a balanced diet with lots of produce and whole grains, you're getting prebiotics. So, you know, supplementation of that, again, there's not really a ton of evidence that, you know, taking things like dextrin supplements or cellulose supplements are really going to do a whole lot, unless you're really deficient and you're not really getting fiber from your diet. We know that most Americans are really not getting as much fiber as they should.
I was just going to say, I'm not so sure a lot of my patients getting enough of that we talk about. Also, what about kids? Because God knows kids don't eat enough vegetables.
It's super multifactorial, right? Because we know that, you know, the American diet at large is not fiber heavy. We know that a lot of people are, you know, I mean, there's a lot of reasons for that, right? There's food deserts, there's social and economic disparities. You know, so I often talk about like really quick sources of fiber, things that have a lot of fiber in like a small serving, you know, so your raspberries and your blackberries, and avocado is like a surprisingly high fiber thing that has a lot of great fats and proteins as well. Or subbing in whole wheat instead of white pasta, you know, things to make your life easy, because we know you need fiber. So the goal is 25 to 30 grams of fiber a day. That's going to feed your microbiome and ensure that they're healthy, but it's also going to prevent things like diverticulosis and diverticulitis and pancreatitis and constipation and all sorts of, you know, gastrointestinal related things, as well as the cardiovascular stuff, right? And so, you know, there's when you're looking at probiotics versus prebiotics, so your fiber supplements, there's not a ton of evidence that prebiotics or fiber supplements are harmful in and of themselves. So, you know, mostly they're going to be things like psyllium husk, which is like your Metamucil, or dextrin, which is like your Benefiber. And these are these are pretty much like starches that have been harvested from seeds, right? So they make it into a powder that you can mix up with liquids or warm foods, and then you can, you know, take them. You know, they're, if you're looking at things beyond just like those basic fiber supplements, a lot of the ones marketed as prebiotics, they can contain other things. So you want to make sure that you're checking the ingredients, because we know supplements are not regulated and they could have things in them that could interfere or interact with medications you're taking. And of course, steer clear from ones that are like saying that they're going to detox your liver, because that's not what fiber is doing. So yeah.
What about in chicory root inulin? That's the big one.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's again, it's another, you know, situation where like the goal is you want to get this, from your diet when you can. So inulin is another fiber. It's a fructan or a fructooligosaccharide. So again, it's a carbohydrate. They're all carbohydrates. And these ones are ones just like these non-nutritive sweeteners that we don't extract calories from, or we don't extract energy from. So they're feeding the bacteria in your gut and they're helping with stool formation and passage and GI function. And so again, there's not a ton of evidence that chicory supplements are harmful in and of themselves. But all of these prebiotics, all of these fibers, if you're taking them and you're not used to that much fiber in your diet, you have to also compensate with water. You have to increase your fluid intake, because what these things do is they suck fluid out of your body, essentially, the food you're consuming, so they can form the bulk of your stool. And so if you're only taking in fiber and you're not increasing your water intake, that can lead to some undesirable consequences, things like constipation and hemorrhoids. And many people who are not used to eating a lot of fiber, they're going to experience gas and bloating and things like that. Especially if you're going from 0 to 60, you want to kind of ease into increasing your fiber intake. And some of that is because of the physical process of how these fibers work by kind of sucking water. But it's also, you're giving more food to your bacteria in your gut, and they make gas as a byproduct. You know, the methane and things you fart out, that's gas from bacteria. So
yeah, we got a nasty email from the climatologist about Spencer recently.
He's worse than the cows, right?
Yeah,
that inulin was tearing me up.
But it's one, you know, I think with the fiber supplements, like I personally do, I take Metamucil. I actually had colorectal surgery a few years back. And so I am very cognizant of a high fiber diet. And I do a glass of Metamucil because I'm like an 80-year-old woman. But again, like I also am very aware of making sure that the majority of my diet includes, you know, fibrous foods and things like that.
Let's see if we can sum this up. So microbiome, quite complex, much bigger and more in depth than anybody probably really understands. It depends on, we really can't measure it accurately with at-home tests because we're only getting a small part of it that comes out with the stool.
Some of it we can't control, right? Some of it is kind of our own personalized thing, and sometimes it's probably better for some of us than what other people have, right? Some people may have this whole metabolic part. You know what I'm thinking? It seems
genetic? Is part of it genetic, or is it mostly dietary patterns?
Well, some of it's genetic.
Also vaginal flora,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I mean,
right?
Yes, from exactly. How you were born, so how you were born can impact that initial colonization. So vaginal versus cesarean delivery can impact it. But it's also like, your environment you grew up in, because you are exposed to trillions of bacteria in your house, whether you have pets, whether you played outside, whether you live in urban or rural. But there is some genetic component as well, because, you know, everyone has a slightly different physiology. And so certain bacteria are going to be able to persist better in some people than others. And we can't diagnose that, right? We can't look at a person and look at their genetics and look at the bacteria genetics and say, well, you know, this species is going to live better in this person, and that's a better species, because that's not the story. It's way too diverse and way too dynamic, I think, is the big thing, is that your microbiome is going to change anytime you put an input in, which means anytime you eat something. It doesn't matter whether it is a nutritive sugar, like a fructose or a glucose or a sucrose, or it's a non-nutritive sugar like a stevia or a sucralose or an aspartame, or whether it's a fat or whether it's a protein. Because those bacteria are all responding to their food as well, which is what you're eating.
Great. So, I mean, do you think any of these at-home tests are worth anything?
No.
Zoe, Viome, what are the other ones?
There's so many.
I think. Well, we just lost those sponsorships.
I did.
Yeah, we weren't going to get them anyway.
I did an interview with Inverse about this, and all of them, first of all, they're not CLIA regulated. They're not validated. They're not FDA approved. There's no, it's the Wild West, you know, supplements too, but even these at home, you know, biohacking tests. And some of them look at RNA of bacteria, meaning they're looking at the actual expressed genes or proteins of a bacteria. Some are just looking at the DNA, which is the whole genome. So you can't even compare one to the other because they all use different methodologies and they're all each detecting only a subset of bacterial species. So like, you could use it if you were solely curious, but you can't use it to inform any sort of diagnostic or clinical, you know, implementation.
Do you think we'll ever get to a point where there's going to be something we can test, let's say in 20 years?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think there's a, like, microbiome is a really, really hot area of research right now. You know, but again, it's so complex. It's so unique. It's, you know, it's probably even more unique than cancer. So I think fully understanding the scope of it is just, you know, it's really hard. We've been limited by the technology at this point. But yeah, I mean, a couple decades down the line, we might be able to have like certain microbiome markers that could be indicative of a risk. I don't know if it's necessarily going to be like a diagnostic, you know, this, you have this disease versus you don't, but I think it could look at things like risk profile if you had certain proportions of certain species. But I think that's a way off.
Yeah. And so these clinicians and these other, you know, online entities and whatnot, who basically make all their marketing claims based on talking about the gut microbiome. So what you're telling us is what we suspected, that that's a huge red flag of quackery. The quacks can quack.
Okay. It really is. And, you know, you're just wasting your money, right? Because there's nothing that it's going to tell you that you can actually take an actionable step or going to give you any information about your overall health or underlying disease risk or anything like that. You know, it's not like it's giving you information that your clinician wouldn't already give you, right? You know, those sorts of things, you know, they make claims, oh, well, you change your microbiome, therefore you're at risk for cardiovascular disease. Your clinician should, you know, be able to run tests that are going to assess risks for cardiovascular disease or hyperlipidemia or any of these other, you know, metabolic issues. We have ways of detecting that already.
Yes, we do. For anybody listening out there, we don't need to go crazy with this stuff.
All right. If there's anybody out there who is interested in the microbiome that you know, friends, family, make sure you share this podcast. Make sure you follow Dr. Andrea Love on Instagram. What's your handle?
My handle is at dr.andrealove, and the podcast is at Unbiased SciPod.
It's a great podcast.
And you guys, I love, I don't listen to other podcasts because I don't have time, but I love your graphics about your podcast.
Oh, thank you.
They are really good, really good. Well done stuff. So pay attention.
Yeah. And we know you don't get paid a lot for these things. So we appreciate your efforts. So thank you. What were you going to say?
Oh, I was going to say our learning curve for those graphics has increased over the years. The first batch of them early on in the pandemic were rough.
Nice. That's how it all works. Yeah. All right. Here's our outro.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities. We'll be right back.